thinking out of the box for breakfast. The cereal box, that is.
Can't have falafel in the morning.
What about something like meaty? I'm looking for something like meaty, like a bacon and egg sort of thing.
We don't have that stuff. We have meat, but we have shish kebab.
Okay.
All kebab things.
So what would you recommend that we have?
Breakfast? Everything for breakfast. Bibimbap, we call it bibimbap. There's egg is in there, and seafood, lots of seafood, like a shrimp, anything else from sea. I love to have barbecue in the morning. Why not? But
what about sliced pig feet? Is that something that you made in the morning?
Sure.
Hey, breakfast isn't just for Wheaties anymore. Much of the world gets its snap, crackle, and pop from savory foods. Mark Bittman, the cook guru and New York Times writer, delivers breakfast for champions, hot foods, fish, and falafel. Mmm, good. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. Daljeet Dhaliwal is in for Adora Udoji. Welcome to breakfast, Daljeet.
Oh, thank you very much, John. Enjoying it tremendously. I've been tucking into my kebabs, and we'll get to that a little later on. But, you know, the top story this morning, obviously, the price tag for the auto bailout bill goes up, and so do the number of people who are going to be losing their jobs and facing off with Facebook, another story that we're going to be touching on. And as you just heard, we're going to be hacking into your breakfast routine. Those stories coming up a little later on, but first the headlines.
Chrysler and GM say 50,000 more jobs are on the block. That's part of their viability plan. One of those jobs is Joe Magicolda. He's a 31-year-old GM veteran with no idea what this is going to mean for him.
I'm sure we'll be the last to know, and it's usually right around the end of the year. They always try to save the bad news for Christmas time for some reason. I'm sure we'll just kind of limp along until then.
The economic deep freeze also continues for homeowners. President Obama is going to be focused today on a White House plan to help homeowners. He's in Phoenix. Among other things, the program will offer government cash to lenders to cut interest rates for those in danger of foreclosure. More than 2.3 million homeowners faced foreclosure last year, and Arizona has one of the highest rates in the country.
And speaking of housing, a new report on home construction is coming out a little later on this hour. We'll bring that to you, as well as new numbers on industrial production. And looking abroad, the president is going to send 17,000 more troops to Afghanistan. That's U.S. troops. And this is going to end up boosting the American presence there to about 50,000 American troops. There are also NATO and, of course, Afghan troops operating in the area, all trying to reduce the growing threat of militancy. The Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, is in Indonesia today as part of her Asia trip. President Obama promises a major speech in a Muslim capital soon, and there's talk that it could be Jakarta. It's the world's most populous Muslim nation, and of course the president did live there when he was a child.
World markets mostly down. The futures have turned around on Wall Street. We'll stay tuned for that. But what are you saying about the auto bailout?
This is Dale on Long Island. I was having sushi for breakfast. It was a very nice breakfast, sushi. So I would recommend it.
Answer, nothing. You're more concerned with breakfast, and you should be. Call us with your breakfast ideas at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Well, if you're having breakfast, maybe your appetite is affected by the announcement yesterday from GM and Chrysler. If you total up the numbers of jobs affected, it could be 50,000. Plants are going to be closing. Billions of dollars more are going to be asked from the Federal Treasury to demonstrate so-called viability for an industry that is so far from profitability. It really makes you wonder if they can ever get there. But you don't have to be a worker on an auto assembly line to feel about like this. Concerning your job this morning.
You know, right now we're kind of in limbo. You try to be responsible and build a good product and hang in there and do your job.
That's a GM worker interviewed by the BBC yesterday. You know, virtually every job in the country is at limbo if all of the auto industry goes. Is this the end of an industry, the end of an era? Can we trust that these companies, this industry, can come up with the transportation solutions that are going to be well beyond cars in this century if we get to that point? Well, joining us is Nick Bunkley from the New York Times. He's a writer in Detroit covering the auto industry announcements yesterday. It was a late news conference by General Motors. Chrysler presented its plan. As I said, it's a reconstruction plan that's supposed to demonstrate to the U.S. government that these companies are viable and worth investing more money in. And they ask for more. GM and Chrysler both ask for billions more. Nick, can you set the numbers out for me? Because Rick Wagoner, CEO of GM, was a little confusing into what he was asking for versus what he's already received from the federal government.
Basically, the numbers come down to another $14 billion between the two companies is what they're asking for compared to what they had previously said that they would need. And for General Motors, they say that they now need a total of $30 billion. And that's that includes about $13.4 billion that they've gotten already. And Chrysler says they need $9 billion, which is inclusive of $4 billion that they have received already.
Now, we've already mentioned that for General Motors, five additional facilities are going to close. They're going to get rid of some brands. Chrysler's going to get rid of some brands. What is going to vanish from the showrooms and sort of auto lexicon of America as a result of what was announced yesterday?
Well, we actually still don't know yet because some of these brands, their fate is a little bit up in the air. But it's sounding pretty likely at this point that Hummer may just be going away because they put a pretty limited window on finding something to do with that or it basically gets shut down at the end of March. Then there's a couple of other brands, Saab and Saturn, which Saturn was a brand that they started 20 years ago with some pretty high hopes that now, of course, may be disappearing within a couple of years because they just can't really support it anymore. And then at Chrysler, there's a couple of models that they're getting rid of, the Dodge Durango, Chrysler Aspen. Those are some big SUVs that of course, have just not been selling very well, and the plant that they were built at actually closed in December, so they haven't even been built for a couple of months.
Wow.
And then there's the Chrysler PT Cruiser, which is I'm sure something everyone kind of recognizes out on the road, the retro-styled car that was one of those hits that Chrysler had over the years with their design that they'd always been so well known for.
Nick, what's your take on the thrust of the restructuring plan? Is there enough in there to satisfy the government's? Is it good enough for them?
Well, I think what we need to see is actually what's going to be the response to their increased requests here for more money. GM seemed to indicate that the Treasury Department was expecting a little bit of an increase in the request, but at the same time, this is basically at least doubling the amount of money that has been given out already. There was some pending requests still in there, but to go from $17 billion that's been handed out to $39 billion. We'll have to see if the administration thinks that's worth doing. And then, assuming that money does get handed out, it's still just such a wild card of what the market is going to be
right.
In the next couple of years.
He was saying 9.5 million units, 9.5 million units next year. That's low. And is even that reasonable?
Well, at some point, the market just has to stop going down because you're scrapping 12.5 million or so vehicles a year, and right now we're selling at a rate below that. So you're getting rid of more cars off the roads than you're adding right now, and that just can't keep going on forever. But some of the numbers that are in these plans, as far as what they're forecasting for the next few years, are pretty sobering. I mean, Chrysler's saying essentially that there's a couple of scenarios they're taking into account. One is that this is the worst year, and then another is that this is about what it's going to be like for the next 4 years. And,
wow.
And their forecast for this year is that it's going to be a 40-year low in sales, which when you account for how much the population has grown since 1969, you'd have to go even farther back to get the equivalent of what we're going through right now.
If they end up getting this extra infusion of cash that they're asking for, how long would it be for them to be viable? Because they believe that they can be viable.
Right. Well, they did emphasize that that if they get this money, that they believe they can be viable. And GM, they said that they could be at a break-even point within basically 2 years and start to be profitable again. Of course, we've heard a lot of the same kind of forecasting before, that that these companies are a couple of years away from being profitable, and of course, the market just dropped out on them. But they both talked about their plan being to start repaying these loans by 2012, which indicates that by then they feel they would be in enough of a position to start giving back this money.
Well, Nick, that is something to think about. And we're going to let you go, but it's so amazing. They're just grasping to be a nonprofit at this point, Daljit. Right now, they're a little more than a charity. They're hoping to get to nonprofit, and the idea of actual profitability is way out there beyond the horizon. Nick Bunkley, thanks so much for setting us straight on all those numbers. From Detroit, Nick Bunkley is a writer for our partner at the New York Times covering Detroit's troubled auto industry. And let's go out on the human cost here. GM alone, 47,000 jobs. I'm looking for a silver lining this morning. Pete Ron, director of the Missouri Department of Transportation. Good morning. Are you there?
Good morning, John. Yes, I am.
So Barack Obama signs that stimulus bill, and Pete, you're already handing out checks?
Absolutely. We within minutes of him signing the bill, we passed out a check for $212,000.
Man, now this Osage River Bridge, that connects what and what, Pete?
Well, it runs from U.S. 54 over to Fort Leonard Wood, which is a military base.
And it's in pretty bad shape, is that right?
Oh, it's horrible shape, but built in 1933, has holes in the deck and concrete falling off the side.
Oh, man, get that baby out of here. Replacing it might just be the first project in the nation to be funded by this economic stimulus package, then.
Well, we're very confident that this is the first project that's been awarded and people put to work.
So, Pete, how much is a four-lane bridge across a mid-sized river these days? What's that going for?
Well, you know, this is a very economical bridge. We're building it for $8.5 million.
That's Pete Rahm, the director of the Missouri Department of Transportation. And, you know, Pete, how symbolic is this to the people of Missouri, even spending $8 million and change on a bridge, being the first stimulus project in the nation? How important is that to boost people's feelings at this point in time?
Well, I think it's very important. What we're talking about is putting people to work. We're going to support about 250 jobs with the project we launched yesterday, people that were being laid off by the contractor who now have jobs.
So do you see people getting smiles on their faces when they hear what you're saying?
Well, they were yesterday when we launched the project. There were a lot of happy construction workers there. So this, I think this is important to also demonstrate to the country that the highway industry can be a factor in addressing the problems of the recession.
Well, they're handing out checks there in Missouri. Thank you for joining us, Pete Rahm. He's the director of the Missouri Department of Transportation, giving us a great snapshot of the U.S. economy there from Missouri to Detroit and back. They're starting to spend the money, and it's good to know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we should remind people that there are layoffs being considered in the state of California, where there's a budget impasse going on right now. It's not just GM workers who are on pins and needles. Listen to this waitress from Sacramento.
A lot of state workers and, you know, a lot of people that come in here are being affected by it. The first Furlough Friday, we were busy, but I'm thinking that every time they have Furlough Friday, we're not going to be busy because they're not going to have money, you know.
And that was Val Simmons, who works at the Cornerstone Restaurant in Midtown Sacramento, you know, looking at the impact that it's having on their community. I mean, she isn't somebody that's lost her jobs, but she's certainly coming into contact with a lot of people who are worried about losing their jobs and have lost their jobs. And California, of course, you know, hasn't closed in that $42 billion budget gap that it's experiencing.
And, you know, the final thing, and actually the president is going to be dealing with this later today, is everyone's on pins and needles about their mortgage. And apparently $50 billion is up to be outlined in a new program from the president, who's in Phoenix today, to talk about foreclosure relief for people who are worried about their mortgage. A lot of relief and a lot of concerns there all through the economy.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Don't know if you've made your breakfast choices yet this morning or kicking around your kitchen trying to figure out what to have. We're thinking way out of the box for breakfast this morning. Mark Bittman's going to be here later on in the program. Hey, think about olives. Think about miso for breakfast. What do you think about that?
Roasted carrots for breakfast?
Maybe I'm dating myself, Daljit, but you remember the era of Gutenberg, you know, the first printing presses back in the 1600s?
You're dating yourself a little bit, John.
Well, in those times when printing presses were the only way you published information, the people with the printing presses were some of the most powerful people in the society. And of course, they got the attention of the kings and other authorities, and laws were made to regulate their behavior. But in this day and age, and we think of it something of as a signature for this program, to focus on the implications of everyone being able to publish in an online, wirelessly interactive world. And one implication that popped up last week has legal scholars scratching their heads all over the world. Dahlia Lithwick joins us. She's the legal affairs correspondent from Slate. We're thrilled to have her on the line from Virginia. Dahlia, thanks for being with us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Now, I can publish online on my desktop, on my laptop, and anyone can publish from their cell phone if they upload text and, in this case, pictures. What are the legal implications, and this is literally the story, of young people, minors, underage kids, uploading pictures of themselves to each other, maybe they're not clothed, coming into contact with anti-pornography laws, which are certainly made for adults?
Right. Well, certainly, let's say for sure they're not clothed in this this particular scenario, because that's the issue. The issue really is a spate of prosecutions that have been very, very draconian across the country of young people, often as young as, you know, middle school or 13, 14-year-old kids who, I think, invariably, without knowing the consequences, take shots of themselves naked, send them to their boyfriend or girlfriend, and find themselves sometimes facing these felony pornography prosecutions. And there's the piece that I did about it for Slate and for Newsweek this week talks about particularly a case in Pennsylvania where three young girls, ages 13 and 14, in Pennsylvania sent pictures of themselves to their boyfriends.
Wow.
I mean, this was in no way an attempt to sort of disseminate porn under the classic sense of what porn is. And all six of these kids were charged with these very, very serious sex crimes that end up becoming, now in this particular case, they pled, I think all but one pled to misdemeanors, but they become eligible to be on sex offender registries for decades.
Oh, there are two things going on here quickly, and then Daljit is itching to get in here. One, it seems like the technology is enabling behaviors on the part of these kids that they would probably not do under any other circumstances. That's one. Number two, there doesn't seem to be any law for minors who are also so-called pornographers. Is that fair?
I think both of those observations are right. You know, this is behavior that's happening very far in advance of legal structures to constrain it. This is the kind of thing that, you know, the most crazy thing I did with technology when I was a kid was, you know, turn from Love Boat to Fantasy Island on the TV. I just didn't have the ability to do these things. Most of the stories I'm hearing are kids who had no idea that there would be legal consequences. And then I think you're quite right. You know, this is just doesn't fit under any classic definition of porn. You know, the guy with the shabby overcoat and the predator preying on children. These are very, very frequently cases where, to the extent that there's a predator, these 13-year-old girls are sort of preying on themselves.
So, Dahlia, I mean, if you don't think that it should be dealt with by the criminal justice system, I mean, what do you think is sort of what's behind this kind of extreme reaction? If I'm reading what you're saying correctly, you think that, what is it, a knee-jerk reaction or what?
Yeah, Yeah, I mean, I think that to the extent that these cases, many of these cases are being prosecuted using very, very harsh pornography laws, I think there's a feeling, and certainly we've seen a lot of quotes from cases around the country, that this is very serious conduct and that kids, maybe they don't understand the implications, but the implication of sending a naked photo of yourself is that within a nanosecond it can be uploaded onto the internet, it can go, you know, to 1,000 people, and then it really, you know, will ruin your life. And so I guess my sense is that the argument that you don't want to inadvertently ruin your life, so let's intentionally ruin your life by making you register as a sex offender, just defies logic. But certainly I think the argument is if we single out these cases, we treat them very harshly, maybe kids will get it that what they're doing has very serious consequences.
Well, as someone who's had many, many opportunities to ruin his life throughout my long life, you know, the technology has not helped me in that at all. And the technology really is an issue, whether it's enabling or creating, you know, more fine print in the law. It's a subject for Siva Vaidyanathan, who's media professor at the University of Virginia, who also joins us now. Siva, this issue of kids being able to publish but yet being minors is a real anomaly. And I'm wondering if it has implications way beyond simply this sort of kiddie porn, which is so attractive to, you know, tabloid media that is even coined a phrase for it called sexting, I think.
Yeah, you know, the pornography side of it is the problem, is that we, as Dahlia has written and has said this morning, once you view it as a pornography problem, you're missing out on all of the really dangerous and harmful bullying and extortion and power issues that are going on as the real dynamic in this relationship, right? This phenomenon is not just about flirtation and seduction among teens. It really is about people using these photos in ways that really exert some sort of social power within their community. And this plays directly into the results of a very important meta study of a number of studies and statistics that the Berkman Center for Internet and Society released last month, which showed that our image of the sexual predation danger that teens face, the Dateline NBC image, is so completely off base, right? Huh. The real danger out there is not at all the creepy old man posing as a teen and luring someone
right.
unsuspectingly into a situation. But in fact, there is real danger of adults taking advantage of teens who are already troubled and in danger, and we are not paying attention to those teens who are likely to put themselves in these situations because we're focusing on
right.
this supposed general problem.
Well, this brings us to a bigger issue, which I want to keep both of you for the next segment. I mean, the question is who owns the rights to whatever picture you publish if you're a kid? There's a dispute about that. And when we come back, Dolly, I want to ask you about, is there such thing as a doctrine of two consenting teenagers in an issue like this that has any legal standing? Dahlia Lithwick, Slate legal affairs correspondent, and Siva Vaidyanathan, media professor at the University of Virginia. We're talking about some pretty interesting internet implications in this 21st century.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. We're continuing our conversation in just a moment. But first, the headlines and housing starts are out. Femi, did you see this?
I did.
16%.
Yeah, absolutely. So they dropped 466,000 units in January. That's a record low. Let me just explain what that means. The houses starts actually measure new construction of residential units that begin each month. So when they drop, it rocks the entire economy. So everything from construction jobs to appliance sales. That's a really important economic indicator that we've just got got in this morning.
Building permits also down about 4.6%.
Thanks for that, John. Other news making headlines this morning for you. President Obama is in Phoenix today to unveil a plan to keep homes in their homeowners in their homes. The plan's expected to offer government funds to mortgage companies that reduce their interest rates for distressed homeowners. Federal regulators charged the Texas billionaire Alan Stanford and three of his companies with massive fraud yesterday. The SEC says that he orchestrated a fake investment scheme that was centered around an $8 billion savings program that promised unusually high interest rates. On hearing the news, one Stanford financial customer had a message for the billionaire.
I hope that you will do the right thing, not only for yourself, but for your customers. And I hope nobody tries to attempt to assassinate you.
Alan Stanford has been charged with massive ongoing fraud. The Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, is in Indonesia today. It's the second stop on her first overseas trip as the country's top diplomat. Her stop in the largely Muslim country is meant as a step towards stronger relations with the Muslim world. And Clinton also took some time during her Asia tour to promote the idea of working women.
There is room for more women in any society to be actively involved in the world of work without giving up on having children.
And also talking about trips to foreign countries, the president will be heading to Canada tomorrow. That's a look at your news for now.
Thank you, Femi.
All right, we want to get back to our earlier conversation and bring back Slate writer Dahlia Lithwick and University of Virginia media and technology professor Siva Varianathan. And we were talking earlier on, John, about this issue of whether teens could end up being convicted as sex offenders if they send naked photographs of themselves. And the other part of the story that we're following is exactly, you know, who owns the rights to people's personal content, the stuff that gets put onto Facebook. And today, after a wave of protests, Facebook said that it was actually withdrawing its controversial new terms of service agreement, and it said that it had retained personal content even after accounts were deleted. So what we want to do is to bring our guests back into this, and I'd like to get your take on this, Siva. What do you think Facebook was doing? Why do you think it was going down this road?
It has to do with the fact that Facebook is like a gated community on the internet, and what it wants to do and what it does with our information, all the songs we like, our the friends we have, what we're doing every morning, those bits of data are shared among a variety of platforms and sites within Facebook, and you need a license under copyright to be able to distribute that. And that's understandable, because that's actually why we want Facebook to work for us. What we don't get to manage very well is what Facebook does with our information, how long it has our information, and what it does with it in terms of its advertising partners, which is how it hopes someday to make money. And right now it hasn't actually made any money. Now, so this change was sort of imposed overnight, universally, unilaterally, with no input from users. And it looked really scary because it was in legal language. And what it basically did was it said, it doesn't matter if you get sick of Facebook, if you think it's bad for you, if you think it was a mistake in your life, if you get off of it, your data stays with us. It's our, we have a license to it. It's not that it was their property, but they have a perpetual license to use it, reuse it, abuse it, and choose it. And,
so, so it
and
sounds
that was
like
a big problem.
Facebook is no longer going to be the fun, easy thing that it was supposed to be.
Well, I don't think it was going to make a difference in the day-to-day use of Facebook. It was going to make a difference in terms of Facebook's explicit relationship with its users. Its users are the reason Facebook has any value at all. Like, we're the ones who actually create the value. And so this was a case of some very poor management of the relationship with the user base.
But it's a gigantic issue that looms not just – and I want to bring Dahlia into here. I mean, these copyright issues apply to Google. They apply to Facebook. They apply to all of these aggregation sites where stuff is picked up and can be – I mean, YouTube. I mean, there are massive rights questions that Facebook has tiptoed into the wasp's nest of, but I don't think there's any sense that this is going to be resolved only at Facebook. Dahlia?
I agree, and I, I think, you know, I agree with everything that Siva said, but I think I might change the metaphor and say it's not exactly that Facebook is a gated community. I think the internet is the Wild West. I mean, this is a just completely lawless terrain that we're trying to scramble as fast as we can to craft legal systems and structures that exist in the real world, out in the real world with real property and real copyright, and then to impose them on this world that is quite different. And I think that the overarching theme in both the Facebook case and in these sexting prosecutions is that we have this notion that our information is ephemeral, that it's just there when we want to put it there, and then it's gone when we want to take it away.
I guess the information being key, Siva, and this is, why isn't there a distinction between, okay, there's a naked picture on the internet, fine, but you know who found those pictures? I mean, these prosecutors that go trolling for naked pictures on cell phone databases, that seems way more perverted than sending a picture to your boyfriend. Why isn't that illegal?
Well, look, we've had a pretty strong moral panic about nakedness on the internet for a number of years, at the same time that we've pretty much acknowledge that nakedness is what drives people to the internet. But when it comes to children, of course, we have to be particularly careful and we should not be flippant. But what we're learning here and what Dahlia is pointing out in her analysis of the situation is the dangers of the persistence of the status or the content. So in other words, just like Facebook will never let your stupid haiku poems go away, on the internet,
and
your
they shouldn't
content lasts
because they're
forever,
really good.
Right?
Have you read them? So,
look, you know, the you don't get a second chance on the internet to fix your reputation. The damage that you do when you're a foolish 18-year-old, like, you know, when I was an 18-year-old, I could do all sorts of stupid things, say stupid things. No one remembers except for a handful of people who I trust and threaten every time they.
And we have them on the line, Steve. Right? But joining us now is no, actually, I'm just kidding. But before we go, I mean, we're down under a minute now. And is there any way to have technologically information posted that has a self-destruct that will go away after a year or a month, Siva, very quickly?
No, but we need to consider both laws and norms that take into
right.
account the fact that we should be able to manage our reputations in a variety of
right.
ways.
And managing
we use the
reputation.
Word privacy
okay.
by mistake.
I just want to give Dahlia the last word. Dahlia, is there a new institution here that we need very, very quickly?
I think we need the old institution, which is parents. I think parents need to teach their kids that information is forever.
Dahlia Lithwick is legal affairs correspondent for Slate Magazine, and Siva Vaidyanathan, media and technology professor at the University of Virginia. We're just talking about some very interesting implications about behaviors publishing on the internet. Who owns the rights?
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Daljit Dhaliwal, in for Adora Udoji. 30 years after more than a million people died at the hands of the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, a trial is underway. It's a long-awaited United Nations-backed trial, the first of five, in fact, of a former Khmer Rouge leader in Cambodia that opened in the capital, Phnom Penh, yesterday. And joining us now is the BBC's Jonathan Head. He's their Southeast Asia correspondent, and he joins us from Bangkok. Jonathan, what happened at the trial today, and also why has it taken so long for this to be set up?
Well, we're in the very first stages of this trial. There's actually quite a lot of procedural work that had to be gone through. What evidence will be admissible? Objections from the defense. The defense is objecting, not least because the first defendant, the man known as Comrade Doik, has actually been in jail for 9 years awaiting trial. It's taken, as you say, that long to get these trials going. But the real drama will be next month when they start taking testimony from survivors of the prison that the defendant was in charge of. This was the most horrific prison under the Khmer Rouge. More than 14,000 people who went into it never came out. In fact, only a handful did. So that's when the real drama starts. But the trial is underway. And that itself is an incredibly important moment for Cambodia. They've been talking about this tribunal to look at the atrocities committed under the Khmer Rouge for more than 10 years. The problem is there was intense disagreement between the Cambodian government and the United Nations over over basically who should be in charge of it. And the compromise they finally hammered out was a mix and a unique blend of both international judges and Cambodian judges and international law and Cambodian law. Fundamentally, the Cambodian government wanted to control the process. The international community said, no, it needs credibility to be a proper accounting for what happened. We need to have some international supervision too. It is working quite well so far, though, at least in this first opening hearing.
Right, and Doik, I presume, at this point has said nothing in his own defence. But what is the defence? I mean, how are they going to mount this case?
It'll be interesting to see what their tactic is with him. He's unusual among the five defendants. Only five have been charged so far. The other four are top Khmer Rouge leaders. The most famous one of all, Pol Pot, died in 1998 before he could be put on trial. But all of them have denied their involvement, despite the fact they were clearly decision makers. They've all said, we didn't know anything about it. Doik has admitted to journalists, he's actually a born-again Christian, he's had something of a kind of change of life, and he's admitted to journalists when he was first discovered in the late 90s, his role in ordering the killings. And there's a lot of evidence against the killings in the prison. There's a lot of evidence against him too, signatures, testimony from witnesses. He is unusual in that he was clearly a man who appears, from all the evidence, to have been willing to quite coolly to order the horrific deaths of thousands of people and is willing to talk about it. That's what makes his trial important. If he comes out and is willing to express remorse, which he's done on a number of occasions up to now, it will, I think, offer the possibility of some closure, some satisfaction from the victims who, in this unusual format, many of them, even the ones who don't testify, will be able to come and make statements to the defendant and to ask questions of him. And in that sense, his trial will be interesting. For all that, he did say, has said all along, I was following orders. And I guess that may well be his, the classic defense in cases like these.
All right, BBC Southeast Asia correspondent joining us from Bangkok. Jonathan, thank you very much.
You know, that's a truth and reconciliation process going
absolutely,
on in Cambodia.
Yes.
It's an arduous one, but
you know,
very
even
interesting.
Even something that's happening sort of 30 years later, right. I think, you know, as we saw in South Africa and in Rwanda, it's really important that people feel that, you know, there's a sense of justice and it's also...
We'll see how it goes.
...a healing process.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. Have you made your breakfast choice this morning? Is it going to be cereal or something that Mark Bittman of The New York Times is going to tell us about in just a moment? Right after the headlines from Femi, okay?
Good morning. 30 minutes to the top of the hour is the time. The struggling car maker General Motors is in talks with foreign governments, among them Germany, Sweden and Canada, about loans of $6 billion needed to save its foreign subsidiaries. Yesterday, GM announced plans to cut 47,000 jobs across the world, and more than half of those jobs are outside of the US. President Obama is in Phoenix today to unveil his plan to tackle the home crisis. It's one of several initiatives the president is taking to revitalize the economy. The Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, is visiting Indonesia today, the world's most populous Muslim country. Secretary Clinton says her mission is for Washington to deepen relations with Indonesia. But there have been some protests in Indonesia against Clinton's visit. In Jakarta, at least five people were detained after students rallied outside of the U.S. embassy. American Brigadier General Michael Ryan is visiting Western Afghanistan. He will investigate claims of civilian deaths at the site of a U.S. airstrike. That's a look at headlines making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi. And have you figured out what you're having this morning for breakfast? I mentioned a moment ago, breakfast isn't just for cereal anymore. Mark Bittman is the author of the New York Times cooking column, The Minimalist. It's in its 11th year. His cookbook, How to Cook Everything, is in its 10th anniversary edition. He also writes the Bitten blog. Mark Bittman, thanks so much for joining us right here in the studio. And we're going to talk about the sounds and smells of breakfast. And there's almost nothing more evocative. I mean, we got the cereal and milk here.
Very nice. I love that you have the snack box or whatever
it's
you call it.
It's the little one. Yeah,
I love that.
Yeah, they used to have used to be able to actually pour the milk directly into the box.
It was
maybe
very
you still
fun.
Can. Yeah, very fun. But you've broadened your notion of breakfast and think Americans are really selling themselves short by staying in the sort of cereal and maybe occasionally bacon and eggs zone.
Well, bacon and eggs is savory. Something about the way I eat has always led me to enjoy savory breakfasts. And I think there was a real eye-opening moment about 15 years ago. I was in Bangkok and they brought me a bowl of, at a quite fancy hotel, a bowl of the stuff called khao tum, which is essentially juk, the Chinese rice porridge, but really dressed up with sausage and fish and bacon and scallions and fish sauce. And I thought, this is breakfast of champions. To
really?
Eat a really big bowl of hearty stew at breakfast, to me, there's nothing better.
Well, we have a delivery, I believe. Leo Duran, our producer, is here in the studio. Also have Jennifer Hsu, videotaping this for the website.
Hello there.
All right, so we've got some non-traditional breakfast alternatives here, Leo. What have you got for me here?
So you aren't just eating that kimchi. That's made with sort of anchovies.
Kimchi with anchovies.
But you're supposed to put that on top of this bibimbap.
Bibimbap.
Oh, bibimbap is a good breakfast. Bibimbap, the Korean rice dish with vegetables, sometimes fish or meat.
I think you've got some kebabs in there for me as well, right?
I do. And there's an egg on top of that. So it's sort of like breakfast.
And these are available in New York. Oh, look at it. Egg, fish. Now, what advantages? I'm going to taste this here. But what are the advantages of this kind of a breakfast nutritionally? And there are some healthy and not so healthy alternatives, I guess.
Well, you know, I've been thinking a lot about this. My new book is called Food Matters, and it's kind of about how we eat. And one of the things that people do at breakfast is they load up on either a lot of fat, i.e. Right. bacon and eggs, or a lot of sugar, i.e. breakfast cereal, or even worse, donuts. And if you look at the alternative as vegetables, if you can find a way to enjoy vegetables, as you seem to be doing now, John.
Yeah, this does not taste at all like sugar pops, so the little anchovies healthy, and the kimchi.
Sure.
Yeah.
Or whole grains, which is essentially what the piece in the Times is about today, which is, an exploration of enjoying cornmeal, wheat berries, brown rice, bulgur, quinoa, etc. in the morning as alternatives to traditional breakfast cereals or, for that matter, steel-cut oats but served, say, with soy sauce and scallions or with peanut butter and sriracha sauce. I mean, these are things that I know that some listeners right now are going, ooh, and others are going, huh, I got to try that.
Well, I'm doing the huh. Oatmeal with soy?
It's great.
And what else? Scallions?
Well, little chopped scallions. I mean, my mother used to eat cottage cheese with chopped scallions for breakfast, so it's not really that much of a stretch, at least for me. I mean, if you like salty food, if you like highly flavored food instead of, you know, I don't want to be insulting about sweet food, but it is kind of kid food in a way.
You know, it is.
Let's grow up and try some stuff that, you know, is less damaging, more beneficial, and has more complex flavors. I mean, that's my approach.
Why is dessert such a celebratory meal? I mean, it's the one meal where there's no dessert, but yet if my kids, you know, and my wife and I, if we're trying to figure out what to have for dinner, if we say, all right, how about scrambled eggs? You know, we can't come up with a solution. Or how about cereal? My kids go, yay! There's a certain celebratory quality to breakfast that I think almost is beyond the cuisine itself.
Well, I think that sugar is addictive. So,
right.
I mean, when I was a kid, man, if I couldn't get those sugar pops or those frosted flakes, I just didn't know what to do. There were years when I felt those things were essential to life. And I think, you know, we all know you get a jolt from sugar and we all like getting jolts. And I think that kind of kickstart to your morning is, I think it is addictive. And I think if you can work your way around that and say, what can I get that's got some protein, some fiber, some real bulk, some lasting energy? That's where that's where all the dietitians tell us.
How's the kebab, Dalji?
Kebab is looking good. I didn't want to put any in my mouth right now because I'm too busy sort of chewing on this naan bread. But I wanted to ask you, I mean, these things are kind of like easy to prepare. I mean, what I'm thinking is sort of like, you know, bulgur, wheat and some of the other
bulgur
things.
Bulgur doesn't even need cooking. You soak it and it's done.
So you can just, it's easy enough to prepare. It's
dump hot water on it.
Yeah.
Right?
You dump hot water on it, you cover it, 15 minutes later, it's done. I mean, oatmeal, I've been doing this for a while, but I go through cycles. And about a year ago, I was in northern Italy in a friend's house, and he had this beautiful tapenade in his pantry. And I went to the local store and bought Quaker Oats, which was hard to find, but I wanted that for breakfast. And the next morning I made Quaker Oats, and I thought about this wonderful tapenade, and I wound up having Quaker Oats with tapenade.
That's a fabulous idea.
And olive oil, a drizzle of olive oil. Fantastic. Can I say, really delicious.
Can I say, you look fabulous, by the way? I mean,
I'm serious.
You have lost so much weight, and in some sense, starting your day with this kind of breakfast, the high or the nutritional high is much longer lived than the sugar high from cereal. And I wonder if it has nutritional benefits and maybe has contributed to your staggering weight loss. You should do a diet book next.
Well, Food Matters is kind of a diet book. But I mean, I think it's true. If you have bulky whole grain kind of breakfast, you don't have the mid-morning lull. You make it to lunch much more easily. You feel better. You don't have those kind of peaks and valleys that are so well associated with sugar and, of course, coffee, which no one can live without, but oh well.
Yeah, I certainly can. What about the really unusual breakfast? You go to the Nikko hotels, or you go to Japan, or go to East Asia. The breakfasts are often, you know, seaweed and miso, and, you know, really just something that doesn't even resemble a grain. How do those work for you?
Well, I remember the first time I had a Japanese breakfast, and it wasn't in Japan. It was in Los Angeles, which was as close as I'd been at that time, and I thought it was really exciting. I mean, to be brought this sort of like a tasting menu of a piece of salmon and some little seaweed chips and a bowl of miso soup and a little bit of rice with whatever bonito flakes or whatever. I mean, I love that stuff. But I think there are some people who are going to find this hard to swallow, no pun intended. But I think that there are a lot of people out, like I said, who are going, oh, this is interesting stuff. I'm going to think about it. I think if you sort of look at your diet and you say, what are the foods I like the most and how can I bring some of those into my morning? You know, I think you can eat better and you can eat happier.
Well, great thoughts about breakfast from Mark Bittman, author of the New York Times cooking column, The Minimalist, and his book, How to Cook Everything, just been revised and released in a 10th anniversary edition. One more thought about breakfast.
To eat at 6 o'clock. Isn't that bad for your stomach? I mean, they just ate 12 hours ago. My wife said, Bill, get out of that bed and go downstairs and cook breakfast for your children.
That's right, Bill. It's breakfast time, Delta.
It certainly is, and we are thinking outside of the cereal box. You want to hear what the strangest breakfasts you've consumed? Tell us your stories. We want to hear them. 1-877-8-MY-TAKEAWAY@thetakeaway.org. And we've actually got a response back. Anne sent us an email, and she told us that while she was traveling in Europe, she became hooked on the cold cuts of meat that you find in most of those hotel buffets, and they can be very tempting, actually, can't they?
Absolutely. So we want your take on the auto bailout at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. Leon writes on our website, Detroit layoffs, first blue-collar workers, now white-collar, result no collars with no dollars. That's what he said. Here's your takeaway.
I think this is important to also demonstrate to the country that the highway industry can be a factor in addressing the problems of the recession.
They're spending money in Missouri. That's Pete Rahm from the Missouri Department of Transportation. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Daljit Dhaliwal.
This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
The worst thing is the waiting. Sometimes an offhand word or phrase says it all, really. There's tens of thousands of workers across the country waiting right now to hear if they've lost their jobs in all kinds of industries. There are layoffs in California as the state grapples with a budget deficit. In the Michigan town of Warren, with two big GM facilities and two Chrysler plants, the mayor says it's fatigue based on fear for the people of Warren. People are frozen in time, the mayor says, right now hoping the rescue will allow them to be thawed out. And those California workers, the ones slated for layoffs, if there's no budget, they were told, they've been designated as surplus. The waiting. American workers frozen in surplus time. There's your takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Time moves for us. I'm John Hockenberry. Daljeet Dhaliwal is in for Adora Udoji. Good morning, Daljeet.
Good morning, John. Good morning, everyone. And here's what's coming up this hour. We're going to check in with both California and Detroit about layoff worries. A lot of people very, very worried. And people are also invoking the Great Depression these days. You're going to meet someone who thinks that the current economy is more like the Long Depression, which maybe you've never heard of. And those stories are coming up a little later on. But first, let's get a check of the headlines.
Well, numbers versus humans. Key numbers on housing are just out last hour, and they are much worse than expected. Construction of new homes and apartments dropped nearly 17% in January, the slowest pace in half a century. That number will ripple through the economy. Again, more people waiting. President Obama wants to see a brighter housing number. That's why he's in Arizona today, rolling out a $50 billion plan to reduce foreclosures. He chose Arizona because it has one of the highest foreclosure rates in the country.
And the housing stats number that John just mentioned isn't the only thing that's being closely watched this morning. New numbers also out on industrial production. They're going to be out in less than 15 minutes, and we'll bring you those when they come in. And those industrial production numbers will include car factories. Very little good news in that sector, of course, because GM and Chrysler both want billions more in government money. And those layoffs, of course, that John talked about a moment ago, they could reach 50,000? They're close to 50,000. All this from new reports that they gave to the government. Yesterday, of course, was a deadline for car companies to explain how they're going to fix their businesses and pay off those federal loans. And besides job cuts, plants are going to close. Whole auto brands will be sold off or shut down forever.
So looking abroad, a couple of stories. The president has decided to send 17,000 more U.S. troops to Afghanistan. That will boost the American presence in that country to 50,000. And news out this morning, Israel will keep Gaza's borders closed until a kidnapped Israeli soldier is free. Palestinian militants in Hamas took him prisoner nearly 3 years ago. The tough line complicates efforts for a lasting truce between Israel and Hamas, but they're apparently talking on some level. Rough day on Wall Street yesterday. Dow closed nearly 4% down. The S&P dropped more than 4.5%. And the open this morning has turned around a bit. Looks like a flat to marginally positive opening. GM and Chrysler's announcement of 50,000 layoffs, five more plants to close. Are there too many cars, too many companies? Are you waiting like the 50,000 workers mentioned yesterday? 8778-MYTAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. I'm here with Daljeet Dhaliwal, who's in for Adora Udoji. For the financiers of the world, it was probably old news. I mean, they've seen the numbers before, and it probably wasn't really a surprise. I mean, if you look at General Motors' stock capitalization at this point, based on the close on Wall Street yesterday, it's basically a $2 billion company. It's a tiny company in the scheme of things on Wall Street, but this isn't a Wall Street story. It's a Main Street story where workers are waiting, and they're not hearing good news. Hearing what came out of Rick Wagoner, the CEO and chairman of General Motors' mouth yesterday as he described the plan to revitalize the company and make it viable given all the money that's been given to it from the federal treasury, it was sobering to hear those numbers. Frankly, sobering, and certainly for the 47,000 workers in GM alone who are likely to be directly affected. Joining us is Micheline Maynard, senior business correspondent for the New York Times from Detroit. Micheline, this really feels like the end of an era, even though not a lot of surprises. I mean, I do think that the entire business plan for General Motors is changing and there are going to be fewer workers, period, the end. I mean, what was your impression watching Rick Wagoner yesterday?
Well, I'll tell you a couple of impressions. One is that this is just the opening offer. And in fact, after everything people heard yesterday from Chrysler and General Motors, there was a statement from the White House, and the White House essentially said, you know, thanks for submitting the plans, And we know there will be sacrifices by everybody involved, and we're looking forward to studying them. You know, it wasn't thank you for these plans and okay, we'll write you the biggest check that you want. And I think as these plans are dissected over the next couple of days, we're going to get maybe some skepticism about what General Motors and Chrysler are saying.
You know, let's just talk for a moment about where General Motors apparently sees itself based on the Wagoner announcement. Four brands are going to go. You know, this could be a company that just makes one or two lines of cars eventually rather than, you know, all the cars that we confusedly associate with General Motors. Do you think that's what's going on here?
Well, I think that they have to get to that point eventually, and I have a story on that subject in today's Times. Essentially, they've said that they're going from eight brands to four, but there are people in the auto industry saying, well, why don't you just go down to two? Why don't you just go down to Chevrolet and Cadillac, like Lexus and Toyota or Honda and Acura? I mean, the model in the industry, which was set about 10, 15 years ago, is to have a strong mass market brand and a strong luxury brand. And yet General Motors has gone on year after year after year with 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 brands. So, you know, it's kind of late to that, and it's also not cutting deep enough in the eyes of some of its critics.
What do you think the Detroit area is going to do in response to this? I mean, the city of Warren, Michigan, right outside of Detroit, has four facilities that could be affected. Two, if you're talking about GM, but if you add in the two Chrysler facilities that are right outside of town, I mean, it just seems like the whole city is in a crater.
Well, I don't know if a crater is the right way to put it, but something existential is going on in this area that hasn't been seen probably since the 1920s, when the whole development of the auto industry began out this way. I think what the Detroit area is having to look at is you don't have that automatic assumption that the car people will always be there, the car companies will always be there, the suppliers, you know, the diners, that kind of thing. There's a sort of people are kind of looking at each other in disbelief and realizing that it's all falling out from underneath them. And really, nobody has a good idea yet on what could come in to replace it or if anything at all can come in to replace it.
Well, Mickey, we typically rely on you for your business expertise, but let me just give you a kind of populist question. Is it conceivable that people in the Detroit area will get to the point where they go, you know what, why don't you just give us the $17 billion for economic development in Detroit and forget giving it to the auto industry?
You know, there's going to be a lot of that talked about in the next few weeks in Washington, because you heard a lot of protests yesterday at both GM and Chrysler of just how horrible a bankruptcy would be and how much money they would need to go through bankruptcy. Well, and one of the points about bankruptcy has always been that it will cost a lot of jobs. Well, General Motors announced it's cutting 47,000 jobs. That's more hourly workers than Chrysler has right now.
Wow.
Chrysler's cutting another 3,000 jobs. They've already cut about 25,000 just since, I think, last fall.
Well,
makes me wonder how much tougher could a bankruptcy be on the people working at these car companies?
And at the very least, the takeaway for workers in the Detroit area is that no matter how much money the feds are putting into these companies, it's not preserving jobs if they're laying off at this rate. Micheline Maynard, senior business correspondent for the New York Times, thanks so much for joining us from Detroit.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Reaction to announcements from Chrysler and GM yesterday on their so-called viability plans. Dalji?
All right. Well, the global economic downturn, of course, John, is going to be one of the many talking points, I'm sure, that Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is going to be addressing when she arrives in Indonesia. Indonesia, like many other countries, is heavily dependent on exports, so it also is hurting as a result of this downturn. To get some more insight into these issues, we're joined by Professor Iwan Aziz, who is who's Professor of Economics and Regional Science at Cornell Business School, and he joins us from his home in Ithaca. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
So give us some insight. What kind of issues do you think that they're going to address when it comes to the financial economic crisis? And what can she learn from Indonesia, given that Asia's been through something like this as well in the past?
Well, there are two things there. One is the fact that, like other emerging economies, Indonesia has suffered so much in terms of its export. Because even though this crisis was originated in the financial sector, but the effect on emerging economies are mostly on the export side, because most of the East Asian countries' export destinations are still in the U.S. For Indonesia, for example, the U.S. is the second largest market for its export. So the impact has been devastating for the Indonesian economy. And as far as what sort of lesson can be learned, I think it's more on the U.S. side learning the experience of East Asian countries, including Indonesia, from its crisis 10 years ago. And I personally think there's a lot of similarities between the crisis 10 years ago and the current crisis in the U.S. So I hope there are some talks between the both parties to sort of discuss about what was the bad things and what were the good things that can be learned from 10 years ago.
And I suppose, you know, they did learn some very important lessons, which could be possibly of value to the United States, because they ended up sort of dividing their banks into these sort of three categories, you know, good banks, bad banks, and social banks. How do you think that some of the lessons of that experience can be applied to the United States? I mean, if it's even possible to sort of extrapolate.
The way I see it is, I think there are some members in the U.S. administrations who are still in the state of denial as far as the financial sector is concerned.
And who might that be?
I'm sorry?
And who might that be?
Oh, well, I don't know, and I think I better not to mention names. But, you know, the fact that they are trying to rescue all the financial sector, I think that is just, you know, unbelievable, because, first of all, these banks are much, much bigger banks than those banks in East Asia 10 years ago. So that means they need a lot more money to rescue all of them. So what they did in Asia, they classified banks into three or four categories, you know, from one extreme is the very bad bank, and then the very good bank, but then in the middle you have rescuable bank and non-rescuable bank. So you focus only on the rescuable bank and the good bank, so not the zombie banks or the insolvent bank. I think there are quite a number of big banks in the U.S. who are technically insolvent already. So, and what really strikes me is that a number of individuals in the Obama administrations who are in charge of this economic policy now, they are the one whom 10 years ago suggested Asian countries to do exactly what I just said earlier. So I was wondering why they are not doing it here. It's almost like, you know, do what I say but not what I do, you know.
And I just wanted to ask you very briefly, if you could, because we don't have very much time left. I mean, she's also going to, I guess, in some way sort of talk about the fact that Indonesia, being the world's largest Muslim population, could be a potential model to the rest of the Muslim world. Well, what are your thoughts on that, just very briefly?
Oh, yes, absolutely, that's true, because as far as the non-economic issue is concerned, I think both sides are gaining from this Clinton trip. On the U.S. side, the fact that democracy and Islam can go hand in hand, it's a proof, because the living proof is Indonesia. So that is good for the U.S. side. But I think it is more for the Indonesian side, because election is coming. So the current incumbent president is running. So I think it will raise his stature in terms of the political factors here.
Iwan Aziz, Professor of Economics at Cornell Business School. Thank you very much for joining us.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. With the announcement just this morning of 5,000 more jobs lost by Goodyear, add Chrysler and GM's 55,000 jobs lost in the auto industry. Five more plants to close. Perhaps it's the end of an era. Do you have confidence that this industry can figure out its way to the future? More specifically, figure out the transportation solutions of the future beyond cars. Tell us your take on the auto bailout at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Daljit? So President Obama is sending 17,000 U.S. combat troops to Afghanistan in what he described as an urgent bid to stabilize a deteriorating and neglected country. That's an interesting story this morning.
And it is. And, of course, that deployment will double the number of American combat brigades in Afghanistan at a time of tension with the Afghanistan's weak central government. For more on this story, let's turn to Imal Pasarle, the BBC's Persian and Pashto service. Good morning.
Morning.
What's the reaction been, if any, so far to this announcement of more troops arriving as far as the residents are concerned and government officials?
Well, as you know, for a while there was this talk that there will be more troops in Afghanistan, or the new administration in America will send some more troops to Afghanistan. So for a while, Afghans were talking about it. If you speak to officials, for a while they are saying that it's better to have more Afghan troops, more trained Afghan troops, rather than having more foreign troops. But even officials are not one voice. Some of them are supporting more troops, more foreign troops. And ordinary people, to be honest, they're also divided. Most of them are saying that it will be better to spend a fraction of that money that is going to be spent on the foreign troops, that money should be spent on the Afghan security forces, and they should be trained and they should be properly trained and equipped. But some others are saying that no, the Afghans are not ready yet, the Afghan security forces are not ready yet, and especially this year, 2009, is very important because there will be a presidential election in Afghanistan. And if there is no security, the election will not be possible. So for some Afghans, it's very good news that there might be more troops and probably more security.
Imal, you watch this story. Give us your sense of what you think the broader thrust of President Obama's Afghanistan policies is looking like. What is it shaping up to look like?
Well, of course, most of the things are not clear. Inside Afghanistan, ordinary people are thinking that there will be more interest from Washington towards Afghanistan. Iraq will be, for once, to our side. So that is a good story for most of the Afghans. And they are hoping that more focus will be this time on Pakistan, Afghan government, and most Afghan analysts are blaming Pakistan for what's going on in Afghanistan. So what they are hoping that the new administration will focus on Pakistan, especially the tribal areas of Pakistan where allegedly the Taliban are hiding. And Afghans are looking at Richard Holbrooke because he is a joint special envoy for Afghanistan and Pakistan. So they think that probably this is a good news. And according to them, Washington will look more broadly to the Afghan situation. They will look into the Pakistan more. And in a way, it will bring peace and long-lasting peace to Afghanistan.
You mentioned the elections there of President Hamid Karzai. Do people in Afghanistan feel that this administration supports his candidacy?
Well, it's not yet clear whether President Karzai will be a candidate or not. Back in 2006, he said that he might not be a candidate, but later on there was more speculation that he will be a candidate. Lately, though, he was saying that he might be a candidate, but again, there was some doubts that whether he will be a candidate or not. It's obvious that after 7 or 8 years, anyone could lose some support. So,
why do you think that his star may be waning? I mean, there have been allegations of corruption, that he isn't doing enough to tackle that, and security outside of Kabul is dismal.
Well, one has to keep in mind that one person cannot be blamed for everything. But apart from that, after 8 years or 7 years in power, anyone everywhere in the world might lose his support eventually. But in Afghanistan, if you listen to those who are supporting President Karzai, they will say that President Karzai was not supported properly by the international allies. They put finger towards those warlords that the West supported in Afghanistan in the fight against Taliban, and then they kept them there. And President Karzai was, in fact, his supporters are saying that though he was not happy with it, but he was supposed to keep them in a way. And also, if you listen to the Afghan government, they say that corruption is also something that is not only to be blamed, the Afghan government is not to be blamed alone. Yes, his support is not the same as it was back in 2005, but one has to keep in mind this issue a bit in broader sense.
Okay, Imal Parsley of the BBC's Persian and Pashto service, thank you very much for joining us. And Femi is here. She's got the news headlines for us.
Hello there. The time is 28 minutes past the hour. So we have a new economic number just out. Industrial production went down 1.8% last month. That's the total output of US factories and mines, and that reflects shutdowns at plants making cars and related parts. And we've had some news out this morning that tire maker Goodyear will cut 5,000 jobs this year. That's about 7% of their total workforce, and this comes in addition to thousands of jobs they cut last year. President Obama will be in Arizona later today to announce a plan for the nation's foreclosure crisis. The plan calls for offering mortgage lenders federal cash in exchange for lowering monthly payments for distressed homeowners. And the Associated Press is reporting that that plan is around about $75 billion. The Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, is in Indonesia as part of her first foreign trip on behalf of the Obama administration. Her stop in Jakarta is seen as a nod towards strengthening relations with the world's most populous Muslim nation. And Clinton told Indonesian officials that the US wants to find more common ground, especially on the topic of climate change. Let's look at some of the big stories making headlines this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Daljit Dhaliwal, filling in for Adora Udoji. Now, with the announcement of 47,000 more jobs gone and five more plants to close, maybe it is just the end of an era. Do you have any confidence that this industry can figure out the transportation solutions of the future? Well, if you do, we would love to hear from you. Tell us your take on the auto bailout. Give us a call at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeaway at thetakeaway.org. John.
So if we're talking billions or tens of thousands of workers, for that matter, we can look to the state of California. It has a budget deficit of $41 billion, which it has to come up with the money for, and state lawmakers, after 3 days of negotiations, still haven't resolved this budget crisis. So the governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, is prepared to lay off at least 10,000 government workers. Some of the layoff notices have gone out. His administration has also said right at the beginning of the stimulus package that it's going to halt 275 state-funded public works projects still in operation, possibly affecting thousands more workers in the state of California. Zoe Corneli joins us now. She's a reporter from KALW Public Radio in California, along with Ryan Sherman, spokesman for the California Correctional Peace Officers Association, which is the Correctional Officers Union. Of course, all those workers are employees of the state of California. Zoe, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Zoe, first of all, what's the state of the negotiations, and are these jobs really threatened at this point?
These jobs are definitely threatened, and in fact, even though legislators went into a session at 10 o'clock last night with the hope of coming up with a deal, even if they do have a budget for us when they come out this morning, a lot of layoffs are likely to still take place, and that's because these layoff warnings have already gone out to 20,000 state workers, and it's expected that even if the budget passes, at least about 10,000 of those workers will be laid off anyway because the state needs to save money.
Now, if you're a state worker, how do you know that you're one of this 20,000? What's the language of them telling you that you could be laid off?
Well, they sent out letters, and in the letters they use phrasing such as "you have become surplus." So
they literally say that?
Literally say the word "you are now surplus." And it feels a little bit cold, I think, reading the letter if you read the language.
That sounds like something out of Clockwork Orange. That's really something. So in this auto bailout, negotiations, the union, the United Auto Workers Union, is almost in there as a party to the negotiations. And certainly there's not a lot of aggression or stridency in the UAW's approach. They seem to be very much in the boat of the automakers saying, please bail us out or else we have no jobs here. I suspect Ryan Sherman with the California Correctional Peace Officers Association, the union relationship in this kind of a budget impasse is fundamentally different, wouldn't you say?
Yes, it is. We've actually tried to become a partner in helping to solve some of the overspending that's been going on in California, but to no avail, unfortunately, and that we're stuck being left on the outside and having our members at risk for losing their jobs.
Some of the biggest unions in the United States do represent state workers around the country, and layoffs are not likely to be confined to California with all of the fiscal crises going on. Would you say that union workers have more clout in the public sector at this point?
Well, we're all getting laid off, so I don't know how well that clout is serving us, if that's true. We're hoping to keep the layoffs to a minimum if they do come through.
Are you worried about your own job?
Not about my own job, but I'm sure worry about a lot of other folks that might be getting these letters in the mail telling them that they're suddenly surplus, even though they're a dedicated sworn peace officer of the state of California. One day they've got a job, the next day the department is saying they're surplus, which I don't understand, because if they're surplus, why were they getting paid, and why did they have a position in the first place?
And the number of prisoners isn't exactly going down, although there's a lawsuit in the state of California which could actually result in the release of prisoners, and that's a whole other story that we covered last week. Zoe Corneli, what is the effect on morale in the state of California? The state is one of the biggest employers in the state.
Well, it is, but you have to understand that California is already kind of at the epicenter of the economic crisis, and layoffs have been happening in the private sector to a great extent already. And so I think there's actually some tension here where state workers are trying to save their jobs. And, of course, it's certainly depressing to face the prospect of furloughs, which are already taking place, and layoffs, which will be taking place. But it's just sort of joining in the rest of the depression that's already happening in California with people losing jobs in the private sector. Foreclosures are rampant here, and we're seeing a massive increase in people seeking emergency shelter. Demand for food banks has gone up. It's really hitting us hard.
And some of those expenses go directly into the state budget. One last question. Is it conceivable that a call for tax increases by the state legislature in California will take whatever whatever stimulus check ends up in the pockets of taxpayers in California coming from the federal government, as much as $400 or $800.
Well, that's an interesting connection. It is important to note that if the legislators do approve some tax increases, those measures will have to go to the voters in an election. So if that money is going to be coming in through the stimulus package and then back out of our pockets through a tax increase, we're going to have to approve that first.
Well, a clearer dilemma I could not imagine, a set of contradictions, fiscal and otherwise, for legislators and taxpayers there in the state of California. Zoe Corneli, reporter from KALW Public Radio in San Francisco. Thank you for joining us. And also thanks to Ryan Sherman, spokesperson for the California Correctional Peace Officers Association. Hopefully Ryan hasn't been declared surplus there in California. Femi Okeh has the headlines.
Hello there. Just coming up to 21 minutes to the top of the hour. President Obama is boosting the number of U.S. troops in Afghanistan. He said yesterday he will send an extra 17,000. He also spoke with Afghan President Hamid Karzai for the first time since taking over the White House. American Brigadier General Michael Ryan is visiting Western Afghanistan. He will investigate claims of civilian deaths at the site of a U.S. airstrike. The U.S. coalition says that militants were killed in the attack, but Afghan police say women and children are also among the dead. Civilian deaths have become a source of friction in the U.S.-Afghan relationship. General Motors plans to cut 47,000 jobs worldwide as part of its restructuring effort. GM also wants billions more in government aid. Joe Maggiacalda has been a GM employee for 31 years. His view from the shop floor of the auto crisis is that it all comes down to bad management.
Can these people be trusted to run anything? This is management that's, you know, incompetent on a historical level.
Both GM and Chrysler submitted plans to revive business and repay federal loans yesterday. And Chrysler's plan includes cutting 3,000 jobs, or about 6% of its workforce. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack wants stricter food labelling. Consumer groups who spoke with him on a conference call report that he will ask the meat industry to voluntarily use new labels that specify a food's country of origin.
Quick look at the markets. Flat open. It was positive there for about 2 minutes, and it's all down to zero. Thank you, Femi.
Thank you, John.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Daljit Dhaliwal.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Just a moment here. I'm going to take a sip of my performance-enhancing drug here.
Don't forget to toss in your roasted carrots from earlier on.
There you go. Yeah. Coffee on morning radio. Caffeine, is it a performance-enhancing drug? Well, that was a really serious issue yesterday as A-Rod, Alex Rodriguez, the huge Yankee, the giant Hall of Fame baseball star who admitted to using performance-enhancing drugs, talking about it yesterday.
I'm here to say that I'm sorry. I'm here to say that in some ways I wish I went to college and get an opportunity to grow up at my own pace. You know, I guess when you're young and stupid, you're young and stupid. And I'm very guilty for both those.
I wish I went to college, maybe became an English major, didn't need that $250 million from the Texas Rangers. Jay Cowett, did you see that news conference yesterday by A-Rod? Jay Cowett, of course, on our operations board in the control room and our Takeaway sports contributor. Jay?
Well, you know, it was a weird press conference. It was a very genuine approach from A-Rod. He really took it to heart that his teammates were there, that his Yankee teammates showed up. I think the problem with the press conference is that whatever he was going to say wasn't going to get him a ton of sympathy. And unfortunately, even though it was a good apology, a strong anti-steroids message saying he was stupid, his story doesn't really match up from what he said, you know, over the past 2 weeks to Peter Gammons, to...
Let's start with 60 Minutes, where he just out and out lied to Katie Couric.
So he out and out lied there, and now it looks like he lied to Peter Gammons last week because his story yesterday did not match up. So it kind of puts him in a weird spot with the press. And also yesterday they didn't ask follow-up questions. They weren't allowed.
Yeah.
So this opens it up to questions forever now. They weren't allowed to go into the story.
Well, he's always been in a tough position with the media. It seems to me he was talking way beyond the media. Let's hear what he said about the lesson for kids from what happened to him.
I feel that this happened for a much bigger reason than baseball. I think God's put me now in a position with put me in a forum where I can be heard and my voice can be heard. And I hope that kids would not make the same mistake that I made.
No, that's Alex Rodriguez. Of course, you said, Daljeet, that, you know, is it all PR? I looked at that news conference and I saw a more authentic sounding, heartfelt A-Rod than I've ever heard before. These baseball players all talk like robots, except for the relief pitchers occasionally.
No follow-up questions, though, so...
It was controlled. It was a controlled environment. I mean, that's why I'm having a hard time evaluating it. It was refreshing to see A-Rod this way, but it's not really going to change any fans' minds about him, do you think?
He's in a weird spot. He's a man without a country right now. He's got no allegiances to the Rangers, none to Seattle. Yankee fans only care about championships. So if he comes in and they win a championship this year or win a couple down the line, maybe they forget about this. But that's what matters in the Yankee fans' mind, and I don't think it really – this apology did much to get him over that hump.
So this doesn't matter, the fact that when he was just young and stupid, he knew that, you know, maybe he didn't know they were steroids, but he knew they weren't a breath mints?
I knew we weren't taking Tic Tacs. You know, I knew that it potentially could be something that perhaps was wrong.
I knew it wasn't Tic Tacs.
That's the weirdest part of that press conference. Three years he took this stuff, twice a month for three years. He didn't know if it worked. He didn't know what it was. That's a little sketchy.
Well, he's always going to be a Yankee, and I guarantee you, we'll talk later about this, Jay. He's going to have his best year this year. Jay Cowart, Takeaway Sports Contributor, talking about A-Rod and the steroids.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. In a moment, another outtake, an unconventional look at the economic downturn with a historian from the College of William and Mary. But first, to headlines from Femi Okay.
Hello there. The time is 13 minutes to the top of the hour. In the last 60 seconds, the S&P was up 4 points and the Dow was up 31 points. The economic stimulus plan has been signed, and the president says that the huge paycheck for the economy will literally improve the country's health.
We have done more in 30 days to advance the cause of health care reform than this country has done in an entire decade, and that's something we should be proud of.
President Obama is heading to Phoenix today to unveil his $75 billion mortgage relief plan. It's one of several initiatives the president is taking to revitalize the economy. The Commerce Department says that construction of new homes and apartments dropped 16.8% last month, and applications for building permits, and they're considered a really good barometer of future activity, also dropped to a record low, falling to 4.8%. And another new economic number out this morning, industrial production went down 1.8% last month, and that's the total output of U.S. factories and mines, and it basically reflects shutdowns at plants making automobiles and related parts. California's government still hasn't closed its nearly $42 billion budget gap, and they hit a new snag last night when lawmakers voted down the $14.4 billion in proposed tax hikes that are part of the budget package. Now, while the back and forth continues, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger is preparing to send out thousands of layoff notices to government employees. That's a look at some of the big stories making news this morning.
Could be as high as, what, 10,000?
Yeah, 10,000 on the block. 10,000 people And that's just in one state. That's happening all over the country. So this morning, another in our series of outtakes. We hear about the economic downturn every day, but our outtake series attempts to give us a different, an unconventional view of a story that's in the headlines. And we hear a lot of persistent metaphors about this downturn. It seems like every phrase we hear these days begins with "in these dark economic times" or ends with "not since the Great Depression of the 1930s. But perhaps those comparisons aren't as apt as thinking on the longer arcs of history. And joining us to talk about what this economic downturn may be more related to, historically speaking, is Scott Nelson, professor of history at the College of William and Mary. He joins us from Richmond, Virginia. Scott, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
There is a long depression that began in 1873, which you have spoken to actually securities experts as recently as a convention out in Las Vegas about this 1873 event being much more apt as a comparison. First of all, why is it called the Long Depression and what actually happened?
Well, my grandmother's person who actually first told me about it. It started in 1873. It was a huge financial crash. Started with basically bank failures, mortgage-backed securities throughout Europe. A whole new collection of banks are created. They fail. It leads to a kind of cascade of failures across Europe and hits the U.S. in about the fall of 1873.
And
it's a nasty one.
And who was holding assets at the time? In other words, how did this get distributed through the population? I mean, if we look now at the securities that are so affected in the various banks, it's mortgages that came from citizens, then went to other banks all around the world and are kind of deposited in various and sundry places. How did it get distributed in 1873?
Well, what happens is the interbank lending rate goes up. You see the Bank of England is particularly concerned about these new banks that are forming and that had formed in Vienna, in Berlin, and in Paris. And they start to raise the rate. It gets to 0.5% a day to borrow from another bank. And when this happens, you see credit crunches that kind of cascade from country to country.
And so what happened in 1873 was there was a lot of prosperity. There was kind of a bubble, and riding that bubble, financial institutions decided to be created to sort of join the party. And when things reversed, all of a sudden these banks were just ghosts.
Yeah. And so the sort of 1870s version of the CDO, the collateralized debt obligation, was these sort of gilt-edged bonds issued by railroads in the U.S. that seemed to be worth something. People believed that there was a kind of underlying value. And then when this interbank lending rate goes up, when the money markets tighten up, then it becomes clear that these bonds are really kind of worthless. And this lots of people start to distrust banks, and people are pulling money out like crazy, storing it under mattresses, of course, in the 1870s. Or going straight.
So that was the hedge. That was the flight to quality, storing it under mattresses.
The flight to quality is gold under your mattress, right? Wow. And in that tightness in capital markets is kind of what we see now. The interbank lending rate. We saw our panic, our depression, sort of start probably in October of last year. But the interbank lending rate was very, very high for about 6 months before that. That's when you could really see the pressure building.
So that was really, really the indicator. What was done to deal with that crisis? And are there any of the levers that were used in 1873, or maybe they botched it completely, to help us today?
In the U.S., very little. U.S. Grant kind of throws a little bit of money into the banking system. It doesn't do very much. What happens in much of Europe is this rise in tariffs. And so what you see is a free trade environment up to 1873, say from 1850s to 1870s. Every country in Europe and much of the rest of the world has got free trade. But what they do is put up these tariff barriers and block the cheap imports. The cheap imports that they're scared about in the 1870s are cheap American imports of wheat and kerosene and beef and things like that.
So we were the China of that year.
We were the China, yeah. And the sort of – instead of container ships, we were sending cheap wheat and cheap beef over. And this undermines the – international trade in Europe.
It wasn't the Suez Canal. It was the Erie Canal back then. Well then, right. So how long did it take to come out of that crisis? And do you see this impulse to eliminate global free trade in the form of tariffs, or we've already had a Buy American clause debated in the stimulus package? Do you see that coming globally?
Yeah, yeah, no, it's you do see that. I mean, there's in Russia, you see lots of protests in Bulgaria, in France, Greece has seen probably the worst of these kinds of protests. But lots and lots of folks talking about raising tariff barriers. Sarkozy, of course, saying that he wants to repatriate jobs from the Czech Republic, bring those jobs back.
And the implication of that will be to prolong the crisis if 1873 is a model.
Probably. It takes Europe about 7 or 8 years to recover from this crisis. The U.S. recovers a little bit more quickly, about 4 or 5 years, partly because we've got a new export. This cheap beef and cheap canned fruits are kind of still spreading around the world.
But cheap fruit and cheap beef isn't going to save us this time. Professor Scott Nelson, thanks so much for joining us with that outtake that the model for this economic downturn may go back to 1873. Scott Nelson is a professor of history at the College of William and Mary, and he joined us from Richmond, Virginia. That was one in our outtake series, an examination of what's in the news by thinkers and voices you probably aren't hearing anywhere else. Daljit?
Thank you very much, John. Now, well, throughout the morning, we've been thinking a lot about the auto industry. GM and Chrysler announcing that 50,000 more jobs are going to be disappearing. 5 more plants are going to be closing. Some of the models that they've been producing are going to be cut in half from 8 to 4. And a lot of people have been sort of wondering whether this indeed is the end of an era. So what we want to do is we want to hear from you. Do you have confidence in the auto industry? Do you think that they can figure out the problems? Do you think that they're going to be viable? I mean, can they figure out the transportation solutions of the future?
I mean, is it over for them, or are they going to grapple with these big problems? And, of course, Goodyear announced 5,000 more jobs lost just this morning. Tell us your take on the auto bailout at 877-8MY-TAKE, or email us, like this person did, at thetakeaway.org.
Hello, this is Charles Kimball calling from Salt Lake City, Utah. I'm not sure that letting them implode on each other is not a bad thing. They've resisted technology, they've resisted moving to the core of creating something other than the internal combustible engine.
Which reminds us of the takeaway this hour.
People are kind of looking at each other in disbelief and realizing that it's all falling out from underneath them, and really nobody has a good idea yet on what could come in to replace it, or if anything at all can come in to replace it.
In the Detroit area, people are thinking about, is there a replacement for the auto industry altogether? That's Mickey Maynard from our partner, the New York Times. We also have a great video on a different take on breakfast shot this morning with New York Times writer Mark Bittman, author of How to Cook Everything. Check out our conversation on thetakeaway.org and a bone I had to pick with him about his cookbook. We want to know, what's the weirdest breakfast you've ever had?
When we were kids, we used to actually eat leftover dinner for breakfast and loved it. Eventually, I got more into breakfast food myself. It's definitely much better for your weight to have a full breakfast and a very light dinner.
And cold pizza in the morning. I've done that before. Here's another weird breakfast.
Hi, this is Joe in Teaneck, New Jersey. And once I was in Thailand, where I usually had bread and butter for breakfast, but I needed some protein one day, so I ordered scrambled eggs. Little did I know, they were going to crack the eggs into a wok full of oil and whip them in the oil, serving me the biggest drenched pile of eggs I've ever had. It was disgusting.
It's the best description I've heard. You can join us at thetakeaway.org or iTunes. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Daljit Dhaliwal. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.